Hello, and welcome to the new episode of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, and I'm your host, Olga Breininger. For each episode, we choose a recent publication in the field of Russian and Eurasian Studies, and today we are going to be talking to Viktor Taki about his new book, Tsar and Sultan, Russian Encounters with the Ottoman Empire. Viktor Taki's book is dedicated to the study of previously unknown sources, such as diplomatic correspondence, captives' narratives, and military memoirs. This book also takes a very interesting look at the Russian Orientalism, so I'm very excited to be interviewing its author today.
So welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, Viktor. I am very excited to have you with us today to talk about your new book, Tsar and Sultan, Russian Encounters with the Ottoman Empire, which I enjoyed incredibly, and I'm really looking forward to discussing it with you.
Hi, Olga. Thank you for the invitation. I also do look forward to talking about it.
So perhaps to start us off, you could tell us a little bit about yourself, say your background and maybe how you became interested in Russian and Eurasian studies.
Okay, well, I was born in the Republic of Moldova at the time when it was still part of the Soviet Union, and I became interested in history early on. I think that I began to specialize in history in junior high school. There was such a possibility. And then I got an undergraduate degree in history at Moldova State University, and that was in 2001. And in the same year, I went to Hungary, to Central European University in Budapest. And, you know, there I pursued my graduate studies. I earned both an MA and a PhD degree from the Central European University. And actually, I wasn't really interested in Russian and East European history until my doctoral studies. My first interest was in the intellectual history of the Renaissance, in the cultural history of Western Europe. And so actually my MA thesis was on Niccolò Machiavelli. But people around me and the Central European University professors were pushing me in the direction of Russian history and of East European history. And I thought that ultimately it would be perhaps a natural choice for me, given my country of origin, given my linguistic background. So that's how I ended up in a doctoral program at Central European University, specializing in Russian and East European history of the 18th and 19th century. My doctoral supervisor was Alfred J. Weber, who before coming to Central European University was a distinguished American specialist in Soviet and Imperial Russian foreign policy and taught for decades at the University of Pennsylvania. Yeah, and that's how I decided to pursue this project on the Russian-Romanian relations in the 19th century in the context of the Russian-Ottoman Wars, and that was what my doctoral dissertation was about, essentially. It was called Russia on the Danube, Imperial Expansion and Political Reform in Moldavia and Wallachia, the two Romanian principalities in the first half of the 19th century. And so I defended my PhD in 2008, and I taught for about a year in Moldova at Moldova State Pedagogical University, and then I decided to go across the Atlantic, and I basically emigrated to Canada just as a regular immigrant, and I landed first in Montreal in Quebec, and lived for a year there. I taught at the Carleton University in Ottawa at that time. That was my actually first course in Russian and Soviet history in English that I ever taught. And then there followed a series of visiting appointments at University of Alberta, at Dalhousie University in Halifax. Then I pursued a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Alberta again, and for the past 2 or 3 years I've been teaching at a number of smaller universities in Edmonton, the King's University and Concordia University. And actually my book that you read is actually the result of my postdoctoral project. It's not actually my dissertation, it's rather a study, a more general study that reconstructs the cultural context of the Russian policies in the Balkans, in the context of the Russian Ottoman Wars. But I think that will lead us to the second part of the interview, where you're going to ask specific questions on that book. So I'm ready to answer them.
Well, let's move on straight to that. So you start your book by reminding the reader that Russia was more at war with the Ottoman Empire than with any other power. And maybe you could start by talking about why the warfare between Russia and the Ottoman Empire was so intensive, so protracted, and seems to be so important for Russia.
Well, the most remarkable thing is that before there was this series of 11 Russian-Ottoman wars, the Russian-Ottoman relations were rather peaceful, for the first roughly two centuries after they began in the late 15th century. And that's despite the religious divide, obviously. The Muscovite Grand Dukes and later Tsars maintained rather peaceful relations with the Ottoman sultans, and it was really only at the end of the 17th century that this persistent rivalry began. And there is a number of reasons for that, but I would say that the starting point was obviously the struggle over the territories that are nowadays Ukraine, right, following the Muscovy's incorporation of the Ukrainian Hetmanate and a prolonged civil war that ensued in the 1660s and 1670s. It was in the context of this civil war that different factions within the Ukrainian Hetmanate's elite pursued pro-Russian or pro-Ottoman orientation, and that's how actually this conflict broke out. But there was, of course, another reason, I would say a more persistent one, and that was the Crimean Khanate, that was kind of a vassal polity of the Ottoman Empire, and that in the context of the early modern period, had rather adverse relations with both Muscovy and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. There was this problem of persistent raids of the Crimean Tatars against the southern territories of both the Muscovite state and Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And ultimately, it was in order to stop this constant drain on human resources that the Muscovite rulers ultimately decided to embark on a series of campaigns against Crimea in the late 17th century, and ultimately one can see that at least the first period of the Russian-Ottoman Wars, the period of the late 17th and 18th century, was about coming into control of the northern Black Sea region. And then, of course, in the context of this struggle, the factor of Russia's Orthodox coreligionists in the Ottoman Empire came to prominence, right? First, Russians tried to use their Orthodox coreligionists as a kind of local support against the Ottomans, but then ultimately, these local clients started to wag the dog, so to say, right? It's kind of this case of proverbial tail that wags the dog, and so eventually, this championship of the rights of the Orthodox religionists of the Russian Empire acquired a logic and a momentum of its own, and that helped to perpetuate this series of Russian-Ottoman wars into the 19th century. And so, as a result, we end up with the longest series of conflicts, one of the longest series of conflicts in human history between any two powers, because ultimately those 11 Russian-Ottoman wars extend from the late 17th century to the late 19th or early 20th century, depending upon how we count the First World War, which also was a Russian-Ottoman war, and they took every 15 to 30 years, so a very, very persistent conflict.
Thank you. And would that be correct to suggest, based on your book, that, one important aspect of Russia's encounter with the Ottomans was that it actually contributed to the emergence of modern Russian identity?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because, you know, I try, in my book, I try to emphasize that Russian encounters with the Ottoman Empire were not only encounters with an Asian power, or rather, let's put it this way, a power that came to be described as Asia, as the Orient. They were also about the Russian encounter with Europe, right? Because it was actually in the Ottoman Empire and in its capital, Constantinople or Istanbul, that the Russian, the Tsarist diplomats tried to pass for Europeans and tried to integrate very much into this diplomatic community that emerged on the shores of the Bosporus in the 17th century, right? So, in other words, these Russian encounters with the Ottoman Empire reflect the process of the Russianization of the Russian elites, among other things. And in this respect, of course, they are quite central to understanding modern Russian identity, an identity which is defined both in opposition to this constructed Asian or Oriental other, but also in some opposition to the European other, because while they try to emphasize their Europeanness, their commitment, so to say, to the principles of European international relations, at a certain moment, of course, in the context of the Eastern question, since the late 18th century, the Russians found themselves often in tension and in conflict with Western powers, and ultimately this conflict culminated in the Crimean War, with which my book ends. Right. So basically, one can see the Russian identity, modern Russian identity, as being formed in opposition to these two constitutive others. And in this respect, of course, the history of the Russian-Ottoman encounters is absolutely central, I would say, to Russian intellectual history, Russian cultural history, in the 18th and the 19th century.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about the intertwining of Russian-Ottoman and Russian-Europe relationship, because since you mentioned that, you know, the discovery of the Orient was also a chapter in Russia's Westernization story, I'm very interested in how all this fits together.
Mm-hmm. I think that I begin discussing this subject in the first chapter, which is about cultural history of the Russian-Ottoman diplomatic context, and I emphasize there that this is perhaps the oldest historically the oldest form of Russia's encounters with the Ottoman Empire. So basically, I trace the history of Russian embassies, Muscovite and the later Russian embassies, to Constantinople, and I demonstrate there that whereas initially the goal of the Tsarist diplomats was to assert their symbolic equality with the Ottoman sultans, and they would persistently call, you know, the Russian Tsars was persistently called the Ottoman sultans their brothers. Beginning with Peter the Great, you have a different kind of motivation, so to say, behind their actions. And this is, this desire to become part of the European diplomatic community in the Ottoman capital. Peter the Great manages to secure the appointment of a permanent Russian representative to the Ottoman capital. That was Pyotr Andreevich Tolstoy, the ancestor of the Russian great novelist. And from that moment onwards, the Tsarist diplomats increasingly integrate into this European diplomatic corps on the shores of the Bosphorus. And then, of course, their goal continues to be the assertion of the status of the Russian ruler as equal to that of the foremost powers in the world of the 18th and the 19th century, right? So it was in this context that you see the first occasion, so to say, for the orientalization of the Ottoman Empire, which at the same time becomes an occasion for asserting Russia's Western identity. Namely, at a certain moment in the 18th century, the Russian diplomats begin to comment on the deviation of the Ottoman sultans from the accepted norms of European international relations. The Ottoman ambassadorial ceremony is not following the model, so to say, of the ambassadorial ceremonies that characterize contemporary European relations. And you see that increasingly the Tsarist diplomats present this difference as the outcome of the Oriental, Asiatic, one may say despotic character of the Ottoman political system and of the Ottoman foreigners, so to say, to the European cultural notions. And of course, it was in this context that the Tsarist diplomats emphasized their own commitment to the European format of international relations. And what is this format? Well, it's based on a number of principles, such as the extraterritoriality of the envoys, of the diplomats, as reciprocity, the mutual exchange of ambassadors, right? So it was the supposed failure of the Ottoman sultans to respect these principles that in the writings of the Tsarist diplomats emerges as one of the important markers of their otherness, of their foreigners to the ultimately to the civilization, to the European cultural forms and models. And so it was through this that the Tsarist diplomats in the 18th century began to assert their European status, their European character. But at the same time, as I mentioned, the Eastern question, of course, occasions tensions ultimately between the Ottoman, between Russia and the European powers, that become increasingly concerned with the mounting influence that Russia has over the Ottoman coreligionists. And so it was in, also in the context of this diplomatic relations that the Tsarist diplomats also start to criticize not only the Ottomans for their foreigners to the European cultural notions, but also they criticize condescending and indulgent attitude of the European diplomats towards these Ottoman deviations from the accepted diplomatic norms. So they see that the outcome or the manifestation of the desire of the Europeans to somehow pacify the Ottomans, to win them on their side against Russia, and so on. So we can see how the diplomatic context occasioned both the assertion of the Oriental character of the Ottoman Empire and of Russia's Europeanness, but also the occasion the early criticisms that the Russians have of the European manner of conducting foreign relations, and specifically relations with the Ottomans. And in this respect, one may say that the Russian-Ottoman encounters demonstrate both Russia's westernization, but also the limits of Russia's integration into this Western or European community of great powers.
So this took us through your first chapter, which is dedicated to one of the three principal dimensions of Russian-Ottoman encounters, which is diplomacy. And then your second chapter is called Captivity Narratives, and it talks about the experiences of captives and the way of narrating them. And something which struck me is the role of religion in the way the captives related their experiences. Could you tell a little bit more about that?
Well, I think that religious history experiences somewhat of a renaissance in the historiography of Imperial Russia. And certainly, if you look at the narratives of captivity of the subjects of the Tsars in the Ottoman Empire, you can see an early importance of religion. Captivity was initially, at least, above all about the religious experiences, right? You know, if we speak about the captivity narratives of the 17th century, you can see how the captives who managed to return from the Ottoman Empire, how they give account of their religious practices while in captivity, how they try to minimize all sorts of possible deviations from those religious practices, how they deny, so to say, the fact of their apostasy from Orthodoxy in most cases. And then you can also see that the religious practices of the captives is something that interests the Muscovite authorities above all. The first captivity narratives come to us in the form of the records of interrogation of the captives who managed to return from the Ottoman Empire that were conducted at the Patriarch's office in the 17th century. So you can see that instead of this compassion and instead of this sympathy towards the captives, which is kind of the normal, I would say, modern attitude towards the captives, you can see somewhat of a more suspicious attitude on the part of the Muscovite authorities, who kind of have reasons to doubt that these people remained staunchly Orthodox during their period of captivity. And, the captives who respond to the questions of the Muscovite religious authorities try to emphasize that despite all hardships, despite all challenges, they in fact were, loyal to Orthodoxy throughout their travails. So, the early importance of religion in captivity narratives is beyond doubt. But at the same time, as you move to the 18th century and the early 19th century, you see that gradually, the importance of religion declines and captivity is increasingly interpreted within an alternative framework of reference. Instead of the Muscovite religious authority, the most important authority, so to say, that passes judgment on the captives and upon their behavior in captivity is the Russian educated public. It's interesting to see that initially this Russian educated public could also be quite suspicious, so to say, of the captives. Is above all interested in seeing that the captives managed to retain their basic human dignity in captivity. And so the captives do not spontaneously and automatically demand or command this universal sympathy, compassion, respect that you might expect otherwise from people who learn about the experiences of the captives. And it was actually only in the late 18th century and early 19th century that you have a transformation, so to say, of this reserved, so to say, attitude towards the captives on the part of the Russian educated public, and namely that has to do with the occurrence of a number of captivity narratives produced by the officers, by the Tsarist officers who fell into captivity, who became prisoners of war in the context of the Russian-Ottoman wars. So, of course, in contrast to the captives of the early modern period, these were educated people, of course, they had a certain advantage, so to say, in portraying their experiences in captivity in a way that would be advantageous to them. In contrast to the early modern captives who give account of their efforts to extract themselves from the captivity, the noble officers who became prisoners of war emphasize above all their powerlessness in the face of the Muslim population in the face of the Ottoman governors. It was ultimately this powerlessness that kind of exculpates them from any possible accusations of apostasy or some sort of behavior that would be considered not worthy, so to say, of a noble person. And it was in this context that yet another occasion for the orientalization of the Ottoman Empire presents itself. So essentially, in order to dispel any possible doubts on the part of the reading public about the dignity, so to say, of the captives, the authors of the noble captivity narratives portray the setting in which they found themselves in captivity in Orientalist terms. They speak about the fanaticism of the Muslim crowds. They speak about the despotism of the Ottoman pashas, of the Ottoman governors. And, of course, that renders their captivity narratives the character of some sort of adventure stories. But the most remarkable characteristic of those captivity narratives is that the noble protagonist remains almost always passive, almost always beyond any ability to influence his or his fate, and it is always the intervention of some sort of outside power that extracts the noble captive from captivity. So most usually it's, of course, the Russian government that sends money, that negotiates better living conditions for the captives, and that ultimately secures their release. But another way, so to say, in which some sort of external force saves the noble captives is the figure of the Ottoman pashas, of the Ottoman governors, of the so-called noble Turks. Who managed somehow to restrain, so to say, these fanatical outbursts of the Muslim population against the infidel captives, and so on and so forth. So you can see how, again, through the captivity narratives, you see another site through which the Ottoman Empire is increasingly orientalized in the Russian publications, and that, of course, continues the orientalization of the Ottoman Empire that happened in parallel in the diplomatic correspondence and in the writings of the Russian diplomats that were considered in the first chapter of the book.
And how about the military accounts? So in chapter 3, as I see it, you're talking about the Russian accounts of the Turkish campaign, and a lot of it is dedicated to the reflections of the differences between European and Oriental warfare. Is that so?
Yeah, absolutely. I basically argue that, accounts of Muscovite and Russian embassies, captivity narratives, and memoirs and diaries of the Russian-Ottoman wars constitute the three main aspects of Russia's historical experience of the Ottoman Empire, right? Because perhaps several scores of Russian diplomats went to Constantinople to represent the Tsar there. Then tens of thousands of captives of Russian and Muscovite and Russian captives ended in the Ottoman Empire during the early modern period, and then hundreds of thousands of Russian officers and soldiers went to the Ottoman Empire in order to fight with the Sultan's armies. Right. So chapter 3 reflects their experience, and it is based mainly on the memoirs and diaries of the Russian-Ottoman wars produced by the Tsarist officers. And indeed, these diaries and memoirs constitute yet another terrain of the orientalization of the Ottoman Empire, because indeed, beginning in the 18th century, the Russian officers increasingly emphasize the creation of the Ottoman Ottoman commanders and the Ottoman troops from the modern European models of warfare. The Ottoman soldiers are often portrayed as formidable warriors individually, but they are definitely criticized and found lacking as soldiers, as an army. You know, the inferiority of the Ottoman weapons, of the Ottoman tactics, is something that becomes increasingly evident to the Tsarist officers and to the Tsarist commanders, who, of course, like the Tsarist diplomats, undergo the process of Westernization in the 18th century. They are increasingly versed in the European military literature. They increasingly assimilate, so to say, the principles of the European military art and European military science. And they increasingly see that the Ottomans do not do that. And at a certain moment, they come to interpret Russia's successes in the wars against the Ottoman Empire, which, of course, overwhelmingly were successful for Russia in the 18th and the first half of the 19th century, as the manifestation of the Ottoman Empire foreigners once again to the European models, to the European principles of warfare that Russia itself managed to emulate rather successfully, beginning with Peter the Great onwards. So here again you can see yet another site for both the construction of the otherness of the Ottomans in the Russian publications, and then also the assertion of Russia's European Western identity.
Now, the fourth chapter, I think, presents the Russian perspective on the decline of the Ottoman Empire, mm-hmm. and it mm-hmm. seems that this narrative underwent many transformations. So could you please talk about that?
Yeah, well, yes, of course, the Ottoman Empire was referred to as the sick man of Europe, and, you know, these words are attributed to the Russian Tsar Nicholas I on the eve of the Crimean War, even though it looks like he actually did not pronounce that, that phrase, that exact phrase. But definitely, you know, this idea of the Ottoman decline was a leitmotif of the European and Russian perceptions of the Ottoman Empire in the 18th and the 19th century. And of course, the Ottoman historiography, the historiography of the Ottoman Empire in recent decades did a lot in order to challenge, so to say, the stereotype of the Ottoman Empire being declining and ultimately moribund. And I certainly sympathize with much of that recent scholarship that shows that despite the defeats, the Ottomans demonstrated certain dynamism, certain ability to adapt to the changing and challenging circumstances, as well as surprising longevity, right? But at the same time, it is absolutely clear that the Russian perceptions of the Ottoman Empire were dominated, so to say, by this cliché, by this idea of the Ottoman decline. And what I tried to do in chapter 4 of the book was to present a kind of intellectual history of the idea of the Ottoman decline in Russia. And what I'm saying there is that indeed, while idea of decline was a leitmotif of the Russian representations of the Ottoman Empire, the interpretation of this decline, the interpretation and understanding of the reasons and factors behind this decline, underwent a surprising transformation, because what you see in the 18th century is this thesis that the Ottoman Empire is declining because it fails to emulate the European arts and sciences of diplomacy and war that allow the great powers to preserve their status, to assert themselves on the international scene. It is precisely the successful emulation of those arts and sciences of Europe by post-Petrine Russia that, in the understanding of the Russian elites, explains their success in the wars against the Ottomans. But then, as you move to the 19th century, this understanding of the Ottoman decline changes, because in the early 19th century, the Ottoman Empire itself finally begins this policy of westernization, very much following the example of Petrine Russia, I would say. And particular individual Ottoman sultans have Peter the Great as their role model in a way. So you see the growing Ottoman westernization that in some respects reproduces the Russia's westernization that began a century earlier. And at the same time, the attitude of the Russian elites towards the West changes in this first half of the 19th century, especially in the post-Napoleonic period. Because Russia's confrontation with Napoleon produces a very important nationalistic backlash that ultimately makes the Russian rulers, and ultimately I would say the Russian elites, increasingly critical of the European civilization, and at least of certain aspects of European civilization. So essentially, under Nicholas I, you have this change from the Russian state being the most important European, in the words of Alexander Pushkin, into an agency that tries to filter the Western and foreign influences and allow only those that are truly beneficial, so to say, for the Russian society, and block those that are subversive, revolutionary, and so on and so forth. Right. So basically, you see how in the first half of the 19th century, particularly in the second quarter, I would say, of the 19th century, you have this mounting process of Ottoman westernization that contrasts with the growing criticism, so to say, of the Russian rulers and of the Russian elites of certain aspects of Western civilization. And as a result, the Russian understanding of the reasons for continued Ottoman decline changes profoundly. It is no longer the ostensible failure of the Ottoman rulers to imitate and emulate the European arts and sciences that explains their defeats. It is rather this uncritical acceptance, this uncritical imitation of external forms of Western civilization that comes with the neglect of the traditional Ottoman institutions and traditional national Ottoman qualities that explains why the Ottoman Empire is ultimately moribund. So, and of course, the most important category that informs this change in the understanding of the Ottoman decline is the category of nationality, right? The Russian word for that would be narodnost, right? So under Nicholas I in Russia, we have the concept of official nationality, which is about this attempt of the Tsarist regime to filter, so to say, the Western influences and block those that are subversive and revolutionary. And so the Russian public figures criticize increasingly the Ottoman westernization policies as ignoring the Ottoman Turkish nationality, the Ottoman Turkish narodnost, right? So, in other words, the idea of the Ottoman decline that used to be an occasion for criticizing the Ottomans for their failure to westernize turns into the criticism of their uncritical imitation of Western civilization that leads to the neglect of the Ottoman Turkish nationality, and that ultimately explains the continued decline of the Ottoman Empire. So you see here an interesting inversion, so to say, in this argument of the Russian observers of the Ottoman Empire as they try to explain the reasons for continued Ottoman decline and continued defeats that the Ottomans suffer in the wars with the Ottoman, with the Russian Empire.
This is incredibly interesting. And how about the Russian perception of Christian core religionists who lived in the Ottoman Empire? I think this is the subject of your fifth chapter.
Yes. Well, I thought that it would be logical also to say to conclude the book by mentioning, by discussing the Russian perception of the Christian core religionists. And it's true that a lot has been written already in historiography about Russian Serbian, Russian Romanian, Russian Bulgarian, Russian Greek relations. A lot has been written also on the ways in which the Russians perceived any of those Orthodox coreligionist peoples. But what I was interested in was not so much the Russian perceptions of each of those peoples in particular, but rather Russian perspectives upon the interethnic and interconfessional relations within the Ottoman Empire. Because one thing that is remarkable about the Russian literature about the Ottoman Turkey is that the Ottoman Turkey is actually the first power that came to be described as an empire in the Russian publications. In other words, a polity that is characterized by some relations of hegemony and dominance of one particular people, of one particular community over other peoples and other communities. So this heterogeneous, hierarchically organized structure of dominance, that is basically what an empire is about. So my thesis is ultimately that before the Russians came to describe their own country as an empire, before they came to describe any other country as an empire, they applied, so to say, the category of empire to the Ottoman Turkey, because it was in Ottoman Turkey that they first observed the structure of dominance or hegemony of one particular group over other groups, right? And so basically my other argument in this chapter is also that the Russian perception of the Orthodox coreligionists in the Ottoman Empire was characterized by a series of discoveries of particular coreligionist peoples. So I argue that the first such discovery was the discovery of the Greeks. Greeks not only as coreligionists, Greeks not only as a people from which the Russians received their baptism, but also Greeks descendants of the classical of classical Greece, of ancient Athens and Sparta, right? So basically, in the second half of the 18th century, there emerges a powerful classicist myth in the Russian culture. You know, this early form of Russian Philhellenism, and it becomes an important means to articulate the identity of the Russian elites themselves. Essentially, the Russians, as we know from the studies of Vera Proskurina and Leonid Zorin, the Russian elites present themselves as the new Greeks, right? And essentially, the Russian-Ottoman wars are described as a reenactment of the Greek-Persian wars of the 5th century before Christ. So it was in this context that the Russians discover the Greeks not only as coreligionists, but also as a people who are the descendants of that classical classical ancient Greece. But I emphasize that the Russian perception of the Greeks was ambiguous because the Greeks could not only be celebrated as courageous freedom fighters, but they were also perceived as aiders and abettors of the Ottoman dominance and of the Ottoman tyranny, because alongside, you know, this image of the Greek rebels that becomes particularly topical in the 1820s, at the time of the Greek revolt against the Ottoman Empire and the Greek War of Independence that leads to the establishment of the independent Greek kingdom, you also have this image of the Greeks as phanariots, in other words, as this Greek aristocracy that was concentrated in the suburb of Constantinople called Phanar, and which was related to the patriarchate, Greek patriarchate of Constantinople, and that maintained very close relations with the Ottoman regime. So the Phanariot Greeks at a certain moment in the late 17th and the 18th century become important diplomats working on behalf of the Ottoman government. They also monopolize the thrones of Moldavia and Wallachia, the two Danubian or Romanian principalities that are vassals of the Ottoman Empire. So they become kind of partners of the Ottomans in their imperial project, while they still retain, of course, their Orthodox Christian identity. And so the Phanariot Greeks in particular are despised and are very much criticized in the Russian publications of the late 18th and first half of the 19th century as agents of the Ottoman government that helped the Ottoman government to oppress their Christian coreligionists. And in particular, their Slavic Christian coreligionists. And it was in this context that this discovery of the Greeks as a people is followed by the discovery of the Slavs in the early 19th century. The Slavs are increasingly perceived as the victims of not only the Ottoman dominance, but also of the Phanariot Greeks. So as a result, there emerges a veritable hierarchy of power relations, a complex hierarchy of power relations in which the Greeks dominate the Slavs, but they are also dominated by the Ottomans. And to complicate this picture even more, at a certain moment, the Russians also discover the Romanians as a distinct people. The Romanians, who, of course, are likewise Greek Orthodox in their religion, and who initially are perceived as being together with the Balkan Slavs, the most oppressed, so to say, category of the local population, and who in that respect command a lot of sympathy on the part of the Russians, but who with time towards the middle decades of the 19th century are also increasingly perceived as ultimately foreign to this Slavic community. Because of their Roman or Latin origin and because of the increasingly pro-Western orientation of their ruling elites, the boyars of Moldavia and Wallachia. So, while the peasantry and the lower classes of Moldavia and Wallachia are still described in those terms in which the Russians perceive the Bulgarians or the Serbs, the upper classes of Moldavia and Wallachia towards the middle decades of the 19th century are increasingly perceived in the same terms in which the Phanariot Greeks are described in the Russian publications. In other words, very, very smart, but also very treacherous, very, very disloyal, and ultimately very, very negative, so to say, in their impact upon the local population. So, to sum it up, let me say that you know, these Russian representations of the Orthodox subject peoples of the Ottoman Empire present us with the very complex and the very nuanced, I would say, picture of this ethnic hierarchy that characterizes traditional continental empires. And in this respect, I would say that the Russian representations of the Ottoman Empire again stand out, because the Ottoman Empire is literally the first country, the first power, which is described as an empire, I would say, by the Russian authors in the 19th century.
We already mentioned this here and there in other questions, but I would really like to return to something which seemed to me of particular importance in your book, and that is your saying that in your book you try to go beyond Said's reading of Orientalism and in a way against the grain of postcolonial studies. So maybe you could also talk a little bit about the stance of your book vis-à-vis Said's concept of Orientalism.
Yes, well, indeed, in all the chapters that we have discussed so far, and definitely in the first four chapters of the book, I use the category of Orientalization. In other words, I stress that the Russian representations of the Ottoman Empire at a certain moment portrayed it as typical of that generic Orient. Right. And of course, this generic Orient was a way in which the European, but also Russian authors of the 18th and the 19th century tried to redescribe the diverse and complicated reality of Eastern countries as being kind of familiarly different, so to say. To substitute, or to subsume this actual diversity of lifestyles, of political structures under this stereotypical concept of the Orient, which is characterized by Oriental or Asian despotism, by Oriental sensuality and sexuality, by fanaticism, by ignorance, by stagnation, by decline. And so on and so forth. So Russian diplomats, Russian captives, Russian military men all resort to this ultimately to this cliched image, in a way the Ottoman Empire becomes the most important representation of this generic Orient, so to say, in the Russian literature of the late 18th and the first half of the 19th century. So in this respect, I do think that the Russian representations of the Ottoman Empire illustrate an important aspect of Russian Orientalism. And in this respect, my book seeks to contribute to the discussion of Russian Orientalism that has been going on in historiography since the year 2000, when there was an important historiographic discussion in the Critica journal between Adib Khalid, Nathaniel Knight, and Maria Fedorova on the character of Russian Orientalism. And indeed, the degree to which the Saidian concept is applicable to the Russian Empire is a matter of debate. I do not think that one can find any evidence of Orientalism in the first sense in which Said uses this term, namely, a cluster of academic disciplines that at a certain moment begins to be used as a tool for imperial rule, so to say. In my book, I demonstrate that although some Russian Orientalist scholars did contribute some descriptions of the Ottoman Empire, their role in defining the Russian policy with respect to the Ottoman Empire was ultimately rather minimal. But I do think that it is possible to see in the Russian representations of the Ottoman Empire an example of Orientalism in the second sense in which Said uses this term, and namely Orientalism as a style of thought that opposes generic Orient to generic Occident or generic West. In other words, this style of thought that is really operating around those binary oppositions between dynamically developing West on the one hand and the stagnant and declining East, the rational West versus the irrational fanatical East, and so on and so forth. So I think that representations of the Ottoman Empire by the Russian diplomats, by the Russian captives at a certain moment, and also by the Russian officers, military men, all demonstrate, so to say, this Russian Orientalism, this second sense in which Said uses this term in his book. I cannot really say that I go beyond Said, but I try to go beyond the discussion of Russian Orientalism as it has been taking place so far, because so far scholars of the Russian Empire and early Soviet Union who addressed the issue of Orientalism did so primarily with respect to what they call Russia's own Orient. In other words, the Orient within the borders of the Russian Empire or of the Soviet Union. But I think that leaves neglected an important aspect, so to say, of Russia's Orientalism, which is about Russia's encounters with Asia beyond the borders of the Russian Empire. And I think that Russian representations of the Ottoman Empire constituted a major sub-aspect, so to say, of the neglected side of Russian Orientalism. And my book was precisely motivated to fill in this gap.
Victor, thank you a lot for your time and for this absolutely fascinating conversation. Mm-hmm. Before we say goodbye, please tell us about your current projects. What are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, well, in 2012-2013, I got the funding from a German Gerda Henkel Foundation for a new project which is about the history of the Russian-Ottoman wars and population politics in Eastern Balkans. So basically, after undertaking study of the Russian cultural encounters with the Ottoman Empire, I decided to move into the domain of the military history, but not so much military history in the traditional sense of the term as the history of battles or military operations, but rather I would say the new military history, the new military history that studies the social and cultural and ultimately intellectual aspects of warfare. So my basic argument, my basic thesis in this new project is that the Russian-Ottoman wars constituted a major aspect of the transformation in the character of the European warfare from this traditional, restrained, regular warfare of the old regime Europe, as it was practiced in the 18th century when the armies were professional, rather small, commanded by aristocratic officers and focusing on very sophisticated maneuvering and avoiding major battles and avoiding major destruction, so to say, right, to the total warfare of the 20th century, where you have mobilization of the entire society for the purpose of the war, where you have population politics or population policies with respect of the local population, with respect of different groups, ethnic and confessional groups of the local population, their putative loyalty or disloyalty to the regime, to the army that is fighting on the front line. All right. So my argument is that it was in the context of the Russian-Ottoman wars that the local population of Eastern Balkans came to play a particularly important role in the thinking, in the planning, in the strategic approach of the Russian commanders before it happened in other regions or in other theaters of military operation. And in a way that was natural, given the fact that a significant portion of the population of Southeastern Europe consists of Russia's Orthodox coreligionists who, from the very beginning, were perceived by the Russian commanders and by the Russian officers as natural supporters, as natural collaborators. Right. And then there is another likewise quite significant part of the local population who are Ottoman Muslims and who at least potentially are you know, hostile towards the invading Russian army. So my project explores the policies of the Russian military towards these different groups of the Eastern Balkan population in the course of the 19th century, and I attempt to show how these Russian Ottoman wars and the policies towards the local population of the Eastern Balkans reflect the process of transformation of European warfare from this traditional warfare of the old regime towards the total warfare of the 20th century, with occupations, forcible population removals, and ultimately ethnic cleansings and genocides.
Well, I wish you all the best in your work on this very exciting project. And thank you for being with us today on New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Olga. And it was a pleasure.
So this was my conversation with Viktor Taki about his book, Tsar and Sultan, Russian Encounters with the Ottoman Empire. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please join us soon for more episodes of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And until then, this was your host, Olga Breininger. Take care.